So, I'll just do it. I'll do that later. Okay. So I'm actually in a very similar position to Daniel, both in terms of the stage of the project and in terms of the actual position regarding the autonomy of cities. And this is a bit of an autobiographical paper for me. I usually don't like gimmicky tricks on scholarly papers, but here it seemed appropriate. At some point, I just felt like I had to do this kind of like a play in several acts, because it's there was a certain performative and as I'll mention later, a bit of a strategic aspect to my interest in the subject and the argument that I'm making, and I think that'll become all too evident as I start talking about it. But I think that this kind of performative aspect shows that there's a distinct feel to different methodologies that bear on the political philosophy of the city, and these should not be collapsed into each other or elided under some pretense of rigor or disciplinary integrity, but rather made explicit and explored. So Act 1, Scene 1 is a graduate student that I was at the time, sitting in a Hyde Park neighborhood in 2004, a couple of days after the presidential election of 2004, not yet realizing that all the threats of moving to Canada of George Bush 1 would eventually be realized a little bit later, right before he left office. My timing's always off. I'm usually late. But I'm looking at all these maps of both the state-by-state analysis and the county-by-county analysis. So this paper actually dates to that time. It's about 6 years old in a way, because I was part of a group blog at the time, and I was writing a lot of blogs about what I saw in terms of the distribution of votes and the fact that cities were almost inexorably blue. And particularly cities that were mercantile cities were inexorably blue, and things that were not cities, and on occasion things that were not mercantile cities, were almost inexorably red. That is, cities were Democratic and non-cities were Republican, with certain exceptions, like, for example, the Cotton Belt in the South that has a large African-American population. But by and large, when you looked at the map, that's what it showed. So the idea behind it is the paper was that mercantile cities, especially cities in general, I'm not absolutely sure about that variable yet, but I tend towards it, that they might have a claim to autonomy based on some structural regularities that systematically and even inexorably make their mores different from those of the country, and I would add from those of non-mercantile cities as well. So contrary to, I think, a lot of a thought and philosophy of the city, I do want to make a sharp distinction between, say, the city itself, the suburb, the exurb, the rural area, as all these having different mores and different claims, but the city itself, that urban core, having a claim to autonomy all its own. So the biographical part comes here. I wasn't always a fan of big cities. When I applied to universities, I deliberately chose small college towns, not because I reveled in the idyllic rural life, but because I wanted to go to a monastery. The problem is I didn't believe in God, so small college towns were the only option. But of course, going to a small liberal arts college town is not exactly going back to the land. And over 10 years, I grew to love cities, especially the big mercantile cities of the coasts, including the Great Lakes coasts, because they offered the kind of life that I desired, surrounded by people I could relate to and understand. And this is a kind of life that I find valuable. No longer, I think, I've mellowed out. It's no longer, I don't find it necessarily superior to other kinds of life, but it's certainly one that I want to protect. And I think that political theory has many uses, and one of those uses can be self-defense. It should be principled self-defense. Self-defense according to a code of honor, inscribed in a broader context of duties, values, and concerns for others' interests in protecting what is legitimately their own. But that's how I saw political theory in respect to cities. Joel Nichols, in an article in The Nation in 2005, spoke of an urban archipelago. Oddly enough, both The Nation and the Cato Institute were talking about urban archipelagos at the same time, right after the Bush re-election. And the idea or the worry, the image of the urban archipelago demonstrated the precariousness of institutions that had no constitutional standing, no institutional protection, especially against state governments. An urban population, this magnifies the problem, an urban population, especially in the coastal metropolises, that had lower birth rates that corresponded with, say, prevalent trends in Europe, but did not correspond to the pattern of the non-metropolitan population. So there was a worry that, that city populations would eventually get, like, all the good latte-sipping liberals in the cities would get swamped out at the ballot box. Of course, this doesn't take into account the who actually does go to the ballot box, but I'll mention some of that later. So for me, in a distinctly liberal bourgeois voice, or as I said, maybe some would have it, a latte-drinking, sushi-eating, Volvo-driving New York Times reading voice, I echoed the closing words of Alasdair MacIntyre in After Virtue with a very different tone. He said, what matters at this stage is the construction of local forms of community within which civility and the intellectual and moral life can be sustained through the new dark ages which are already upon us. And if the tradition of the virtues was able to survive the horrors of the last ages, we are not entirely without grounds for hope. This time, however, the barbarians are not waiting beyond the frontiers. They have already been governing us for quite some time. Now, Professor MacIntyre didn't have Hyde Park, Park Slope, or Plateau Mont-Royal in mind as the kinds of places where civilization might be preserved. But strangely enough, these words echoed in my ears. I thought, there is something that I value, that I find quite civilized, and I do believe that, like I said, I've mellowed out. But at the time, I believed and made reference to the chaplain of the University of Jena, for instance, who coined the current meaning of the word Philistine in respect precisely to those who do not share our way of life and want to govern us, or in that case, kill a student who was called Samson, and therefore allowed for the metaphor to be quite apt. But I do retain, despite mellowing out, I do retain the claim that cities, and especially mercantile cities, are different and can't help but be different from the rest of the country. So Act 1, Scene 2 is now an office in McGill some years later in a pile of books representing about 2,500 years of political history. And I should add an excellent set of notes that my research assistants had compiled on those 2,500 years. So I think that a structural argument is not the only argument that might be given for the autonomy of cities. There are arguments based on efficiency, on history, on justice. But my argument is an argument based on structural difference, a difference in values created and sustained not only through deliberate choice, but mainly through structural regularities, to use Philip Pettit's terms, that mercantile cities especially sustain. And I think the history of political thought is remarkably consistent in its description of the exceptional condition of this kind of city. What varies is the moral sign attached to that description. So in Greece, for instance, we see Pericles praising the openness of Athens against the closure of Lacedaemon, of Sparta. He says, further, we provide plenty of means for the mind to refresh itself from business. We celebrate games and sacrifices all the year round. While the magnitude of our city draws the produce of the world into our harbor, so that to the Athenians the fruits of other countries are as familiar a luxury as those of his own. If we turn to our military policy, there we also differ from our antagonists. We throw open our city to the world and never by alien acts exclude foreigners from any opportunity of learning or observing, etc. Now, Plato says the same thing. He just doesn't like it as much. He agrees with the description of the effect of harbors and markets on cities. But, he says, for if the state was to be on the seacoast and to have fine harbors and to be deficient in many products instead of productive of everything, in that case, it would need a mighty savior and divine lawgivers. And he goes on for some time, speaking of the dangers of openness. So it's not that Plato thought cities unnatural or even trade unnatural. It's that he thinks that they're a danger because they're not easily subjugated to political purposes and to the moral teleology he had in mind. The medieval experience seems to confirm the description of the mercantile city. In the period following the 12th century Renaissance cities, cities flourish, mainly because of the marked increase in trade that was a consequence, intended or not, of the Crusades. But cities were lived more than theorized, and in fact, you find very little theory of the city and of the distinction between the city and the town, except for some ventriloquizing of Aristotle, for example, in the work of Marsilius. But even Marsilius says that the urban life is good because it allows leisure for the liberal activities that result from the virtues, both of the practical and of the theoretical soul. However, medieval cities were a new phenomenon in the world. Harold Berman distinguishes medieval cities from Roman cities, which were centers for administrative control, or Greek cities as self-contained independent city-states. Urban law, he writes, was the law of a close-knit, integrated community, one that was often called, in fact, a commune. And there's plenty of genesis. In fact, there was a Montreal workshop on the philosophy of the city a couple of years ago, where this was a constant theme, how the social contract tradition and many of the things we take for granted today as part of political philosophy start in these medieval enclaves. So Berman, for instance, says that the most striking and distinctive characteristic of the Western city is its historical consciousness. Its consciousness of its own historical development and belief in its own movement from past to future, its sense of its ongoing developing character. And Jane Jacobs actually evokes this on a really evocative passage. He says, every city has a direct economic ancestry, a literal economic parentage in a still older city or cities. And the whole paragraph is actually quite wonderful in tracing what she thinks is the history of New York all the way to Urartu. But I think that in each case, certain structural factors sustain the historical experience. City dwellers who move away from cities cannot sustain the historical community, while those who move into cities, despite their prior allegiances, come to adopt the narrative, the ethos, to echo the two words that have been running, that we've been mentioning in this conference. They echo the ethos and the narrative of the urban center. No similar historical community exists in rural areas. Pastorals about the green fields of Ireland or the little farm in Yauco, Puerto Rico don't count. They refer to a place, not a community. Nor does it exist, for that matter, in the suburbs and much less in the exurbs. Now, I think that these structural features reproduced in historical memory create a very different sort of ethos than that of the countryside. Adam Smith's description of the difference between cities and the country provides some reasons as to why this emerges. He talks about how order and good government, and along them liberty and security of individuals, are established in cities, and later that commerce and manufacturers gradually introduce order and good government, and with them the liberty and security of individuals among the inhabitants of the country. And then he says, the inhabitants of the city, it is true, must always ultimately derive their subsistence and the whole materials and means of their industry from the country. But those of a city situated near either the seacoast or the banks of a navigable river are not necessarily confined to derive them from the country in their neighborhood. They have a much wider range and may draw them from the most remote corners of the world, either in exchange for the manufacture of produce of their own industry or by performing the office of carriers between distant countries. And his conclusion is that a merchant, he says, quote, a merchant, it has been said very properly, is not necessarily the citizen of any particular country. Now this, again, echoes the words of a prominent former vice presidential candidate, who once implied that real Americans who hold on to small town values and patriotic fervor differed from those city dwellers who had no roots or ambitions. And in fact, the title of my paper, Big City Values, comes from Jon Stewart's reaction in The Daily Show to those claims and the defense of the reality, but at the same time of the difference of the city. So I'm going to skip over, because I have very little time, I'm going to skip over most of the what I think is, ironically, the most eloquent expression of the ethos that develops out of the structure of mercantile city life, which I find in Iris Young's Justice and the Politics of Difference, except to mention two things. She claims that the ideal of city life is a vision of the social relations affirming group difference, and that a city is effectively a form of social relations defined as the being together of strangers, In the city, persons and groups interact within spaces and institutions they all experience themselves as belonging to, but without these interactions dissolving into unity or commonness. And this echoes both the community of communities description of medieval cities that Berman illustrates, and also a lot of claims that Jane Jacobs brings up in terms of city life. So that was Act 1. Acts 2 and 3 still have to be written, but I want to give an idea of what they will contain. So Act 2 is what I hope to do this summer, because I think that the normative study of the city necessitates a much closer engagement between traditional methods of analytic political theory and the empirical social sciences. So my claim depends, in fact, on these structural regularities holding and on the two variables, that is, openness that comes from the mercantility of the city, and density, which comes from the fact that it is a city and not just, say, a free port that is, or a free trade zone or something like that, actually differentiating things quite sharply from the countryside. So I have to run those regressions this summer, and hopefully some students will tell me what regressions are and help me do that. But you know, I have another good RA who's going to help me do that. And I have some ideas of what the conceptual limitations are, and I'm a little bit more confident about the variable of density than I am about the variable of trade. And I'm not sure if this applies just generally to all the population or simply to the elites. And Andrew Gelman's rich state, red state, blue state, rich state, poor state suggests that it may just be an elite phenomenon. And finally, the institutional consequences. I'm not going to go too much into them because I think that they're quite similar to what Daniel mentioned in terms of self-governance. I think that just to mention some of the distinctions, I'm much more on board, especially after or in reaction or in contraposition to Iris Young's claims when she wrote on this subject. I'm much more on board with Jacob Levy's arguments against Iris Young's claim that the jurisdictional boundaries may in fact be prior to or ought to be taken as prior to justice arguments, not in the sense of trumping the justice arguments, but rather in the sense of substantially shaping the remedies that any kind of justice argument may take. And I think that may simply be because my interest is much more on the social policy questions, recognition of gay unions, abortion rights, et cetera, than on the taxation questions. But of course, they're both quite intertwined. So I would welcome criticism on the variables, maybe even on the history of political thought that I've reconstructed, and especially in what do you think the institutional implications might be. Thank you.
I'm just curious to hear more about this this idea that jurisdictional or territorial considerations should have priority over the justice consideration, one municipality to another, or should all be dealt by the nation state, for instance.
No, it's actually quite the opposite. The difference, I think, is, well, to illustrate the difference, I think it really helps to distinguish between subsidiarity and a more federalist type of arrangement, which is what I would be recommending. I would recommend effectively the recognition of a constitutional quasi-federal or sub-federal status for cities, which they don't have now, either in Canada or in the U.S. The problem with political pluralists is that we always end up romanticizing to some degree the problematic medieval structures, but something like the Free City of Danzig, you know, with the understanding that was a compromise for all sorts of other reasons. But a notion of a medieval free city, a city that gets a charter that is inviolate, and I think that especially in the illustration of the origins of federalism through the figure of Johannes Althusius, who was theorizing the city, a federal, a multi-layer federal structure where each level of the federal structure had its own integrity and couldn't simply be done away by the sovereign state. Well, he doesn't do this in a vacuum. He does this as one of the representatives of his city in negotiations and resistance, very, very active diplomatic resistance against the surrounding countryside. So trying to assert the independence of of his own municipality. So the idea is, yes, these externalities exist, but they should not be either analyzed or resolved through a deduction from first principles. You should acknowledge the jurisdictional structure is already in place, that is, the city as a jurisdictional structure, and then the issue of the externalities becomes an issue of negotiation. Very often in terms of, for example, light rail or subway systems, this is an issue of negotiation, and the negotiation goes one way or another depending on whether the city is gaining inhabitants and income. In Chicago, for instance, it went one way until the city started to grow again, and then it went a different way. And thinking that the fortunes of cities and suburbs change, both of these actors, the city and the suburb, can create structures that insulate them against some of these vagaries and create more long-term claims. But the idea, or more long-term solutions, but the idea is that you have to take the institutional autonomy of the city very, very, very seriously, and start from that jurisdictional boundary that's been drawn and then negotiate with that institution collectively, as opposed to simply assuming that this is just an aggregate of individuals who happen to live in a very densely populated part of the state or the province.
Yeah, I'm really excited actually about Act Two, the empirical part of the project.
I'm scared to death about it, but I'm also excited.
No, and I don't want to make more work for your RAs, but I'm going to. Because I think it's great. I think it's great because there are a bunch of economists who are kind of already doing this, and they just come very close to asking the kind of questions we'd care about, but don't quite do it. So we can use you can use their work, and the guy who comes up, who's a bit controversial now because of his new book, is Ed Glazier at Harvard, and he has this great essay for Jane Jacobs, which looks at some of these questions about how the sort of economic structures of cities affect the kind of attitudes and openness to various sort of new mores. And so exploring this Jacob innovation idea that maybe there's moral innovation in certain kinds of cities too. And so it occurs to me that one of the debates you can probably fruitfully mine from economics is on agglomeration externalities. And there are two kinds, or what called so these traditional agglomeration externalities within sectors and then between sectors. So your openness measure will probably can fruitfully use those sorts of distinctions to figure out the kinds of openness that may have these effects. And the debate there is between what are called the Jacob externalities and Marshall Arrow Romer externalities. And I think you'll find that debate. Glazier's in there. What's his name? Vernon Henderson's a big name. Van der Pan is another one. And so they've done a lot of the grunt work on sorting out this side of the data problem, and then it's just a question of finding the variables about mores that actually interest you, and then sort of bringing those together. So I think it's going to be a great project.
Thank you. Thanks for the references, and anything that can help me narrow down the data question, Gelman helped quite a bit because it illustrates that only a certain amount of people, that is the people who are more likely to vote, actually differ between these states, and I think that trying to trace the structural reasons why that might be, why the problem is not with Kansas but with Connecticut, like he puts it, would be very useful. I have nothing to say about it beyond that. But.
So I guess I was wondering if you'd had a chance yet before kind of doing this work yourself to map or survey the empirical literature that's studied this topic, because. So I lived in Ithaca, a small rural town, which was quite left-wing, and then I lived in Gainesville, a sprawling southern suburban town, which was also blue and voted Democrat. And so it kind of leads me to believe, well, these are college towns, and so there's something about the number of people who are educated, I guess, and these are also young towns, right? So there's youth. So when you look at, I guess, age, probably race, level of education, I would suspect that when you include those in a regression analysis, they would explain a lot of the variation between urban areas and non-urban areas. So I was just wondering if you've sort of found that in the existing literature and what the effect has been. And then my second question, and I haven't looked at this systematically at all, but I did just sort of open the newspaper after our election on on Monday, and I was kind of surprised as an American to notice the NDP did really well in rural areas. So our left-wing socialist party, right, in Canada has rural support. And so I guess I was wondering, or maybe that's not true. You're not shaking your head. But more rural support than I would have expected based on the red state, blue state analysis in the United States. And so I guess I was wondering whether this is an American phenomena that has to do with the history of sort of the frontier and individualism and, you know, the country founded by a bunch of rebels and anti-statists, or if that is a kind of an American exceptionalism, or if this is something you would expect to be true kind of globally. And on the history of political thought thing, I would recommend you look at Ibn Khaldun, who is an Islamic thinker with a very rich theorization of cities and rural areas and the dialectic between them.
Okay. I lived in Ithaca too, and the college town. There's a couple of variables that I have, and I mention it somewhere. I think it's in here. I didn't get to talk about it, but at the end of page 6, it says, or it may be that other variables have greater influence, like the presence of military bases or college towns. So I think that if you control for college towns and for military base or for military towns of a certain type. Yes, I think that could sway things. I also started looking at, I mean, what impelled all this was the county by county vote. I'm not absolutely sure that the electoral results are the best variable to track this. I'm becoming more convinced that something like an analysis of the general social survey on particular issues might be a better way to track it if what I'm looking for is different mores, because, of course, the Democratic Party has, you know, the latte-sipping, sushi-eating liberals, but it also has the unions that have very different mores. And the coalitions that come together to get one party into power in one place and another into party into another are much more complex than you know, whether... Well, to use another kind of pop sociology survey that came out a couple of weeks ago, the significant differences between Mac people and PC people, and what they wear, what they drive, what they read, and one of the variables that was quite clearly significant was whether they're urban or rural. I mean, in part, I suppose this has to do with having access to an Apple store. But I think that something like a general social survey analysis might be better. Is it an American phenomenon, or at least a North American phenomenon? Because I do think that the data point in Quebec with the NDP is, I mean, it really is. Quebec is interesting, and when Quebec sways, it sways. I mean, it's Quebec's political movements are dramatic, from the little that I read of it, The coalitions in Quebec are, I think, even more bizarre than, say, the New Deal coalition was. You know, the Gaspé gets into the same party with the Parti Mont-Royal, and they are very different from each other. And it comes out sometimes, like in the last provincial election with the ADQ, well, not the next to last provincial election, when a quasi-light sovereigntist populist conservative, quite Catholic, at least in membership and intent party, swept the Parti Québécois out of the second place loyal opposition slot. So I think that a lot of these factors may have to wait. I think that this election in Quebec, in Canada, was, at least with respect to Quebec, odd. It reflects, I think, some patterns. But however, I think that on a broader note, it may be a North American phenomenon. Because, for instance, India, I think right now, I don't think India fits my analysis. The rural vote in India is higher than the urban vote. It tends to be more left-wing than the urban vote. My analysis doesn't depend on it being more left-wing or more right-wing. It just depends on being different. I mean, if the cities consistently voted right, and I think there are reasons why they would vote for more socially liberal parties. The economics might differ depending on, you know, the epoch. So I'm being modest. I'm claiming that it should be restricted, maybe because of the history of Western medieval cities that lead to our own now. But I think that there's I'm skeptical of how far I can take it, but I think it can apply at least to North America and Western Europe. And again, just to add another dimension, the vote for the in France for the European Constitution also seems to track this. So we might, I mean, obviously the wine trade, the French wine trade is very globalized, but it's globalized economically, but premised on the appellation d'origine contrôlée. So it's premised on extreme localism as an identity marker for the brand. The agricultural regions and the regions that had industries that were not globalized at all tended to vote overwhelmingly against the European Constitution, but Toulouse and Strasbourg is a capital town, so that's another variable. But Toulouse, that's dependent mainly on the aeronautical aerospace industry, voted overwhelmingly for it. So there seems to be something about the kind of trade, at least, or the some structural factors that tend to influence acceptance of these kind of cosmopolitan values as opposed to much more localist ones. So, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of variables that I have to sort through, but I think it can be applied at least to Western Europe. I don't know if it can be applied beyond.
Thanks for your presentation. I have a question about your conception of autonomy and autonomy of a city. So it's kind of great as it's the topic of your presentation. And I will found my intervention on two sentences. You said, so the first is, what I mean essentially is that city, while part of a broader jurisdiction, say a state or province, should nonetheless retain physical, institutional, and fiscal integrity. And the second one is, this involves a collective understanding of a city as an association that is more than its member, not as a mere collection of individuals. And I can see from that, and you would say to me if I'm wrong or not, but there is kind of two points I would like to highlight. The first one is, I can see in that a political conception of autonomy, and so it asks to me the question of a process of decision, and I would like to hear you about that. Actually, what kind of process of decision you can imagine for the citizens living in a city, and how it could happen. And yeah, I think so that this vision, autonomy of a city and the vision of autonomy invokes necessarily a question of what democracy should be, and you know, through the process of decision. And about that, when I heard about autonomy and city, I think about Christiania, and you know, this neighborhood, this kind of free city in Copenhagen, in Denmark, and it was founded at first by some squatters, but it became an independent city, and they have their own world, their own money, and the process of decision is made by consensus. So, and this is the second point I would like to point, because when I went there, I talked to some people and I asked how it could happen, you know, a way of decision by consensus. And they told me as a joke, you know, that it takes so much time that they are talking and they are like talking during the war night. So the people who have some baby have to go home. And after that, the people who have some job has to go home. So finally, who decide is just the two guys who are most of the time drunk and who have no job and no baby. And
it sounds like a student assembly at the UPR. That's why they always voted for the strike.
Yeah. And yeah, so it's a joke, but actually my question behind that is that I think there is a question of time, and that in that context, the time that it takes to be autonomous, you know, to be a full part of a collective decision process. So I think autonomy push us to a new conception of time, time you can give to your community for political issues. And I think democracy, and especially local democracy as it was defined, you know, as a real way of being able to live as a citizen in a democratic way, by Alexis de Tocqueville in De la démocratie en Amérique, is indeed a question of spatiality, but is too a question of temporality. And I think this is really important to take this part, you know, in a question about justice.
My argument is agnostic about the way that the city itself is governed. In part, it has to be because it traces something throughout many different kinds of governance of cities, and the kind of moment of autonomy that it takes as a kind of, I mean, not normatively, but as historically as a signpost, is a medieval city that's not democratic in any way. It's governed by leaders of a couple of guilds, and that's it. But even these cities were premised on the idea of statut marbre, that is that once you lived there for a year and a day, you were free to what? To be autonomous and govern the city? No, but at least free from whatever you were escaping outside the walls. So that's the only autonomy that I'm talking about, a much more modest conception of the collective autonomy of the city itself. However, I think it becomes magnified when you talk about autonomy in a much more democratic or richer sense, and then all these boundary issues come in, because the idea is that you are trumping the democratic will of everybody by creating spheres in which the democratic will of some can be expressed in a much more undiluted fashion. It does suggest something that I've thought about but haven't actually articulated, because I think it's going to be really difficult. But it's really exciting for me, and it's the there's something about city that implies living with difference, but there's something about neighborhoods that also implies living with difference to some degree, but I also want to live with some people who are more or less like me. So the image that I had in mind was this wonderful video that I saw some time ago. Because of political compromises in New York City, there was a bike path that went through a Hasidic community in Brooklyn to a bridge that led into Manhattan, and it was the easiest way for the yuppie community on the other side of the Hasidic community to get through to the bridge quite quickly and into Manhattan. And the Hasidic community managed to convince, through political wheeling and dealing, as every community, I suppose, does in the city, to take out the bike path, because, you know, all these very scantily clad people were driving through and in tight bike shorts and stuff, and it was really affecting their way of life, and I think it's a legitimate claim. So what happened? Well, some folks from the other community went in the night and like did some guerrilla bike path painting, and they took a video and they repainted the bike path. This is the kind of struggle that happens in the city all the time. So I think that it. Just like I think that the claim, say, that the claim of Quebec is somehow reflected in the claim of Westmount to some degree, the claim of New York City is reflected in the claim of particular neighborhoods within New York City. And the balance between them, I think, can be quite tricky. But I think it actually trickles down. And a lot of the local autonomy and the local government should probably happen at a much more local level than even the city governance itself. So, say, zoning or advertising regulations being devolved to a much more neighborhood level. American Apparel ads don't necessarily have a place in that Hasidic community where they might be perfectly tolerated somewhere else. So I think that there may be even a sub-federal element, although it has to reconcile itself that with the fact that living in a city means living with uncomfortable, with people who make you uncomfortable. Otherwise, you're not in a city anymore. So it does pose some interesting questions about exactly how far it can go. That I haven't resolved.
Just for FYI, for your regressions, you don't have to respond if you don't want to, but the book I did on sprawl that came out last year is about 40% looking empirically at the impact of suburban versus central city attitudes on all kinds of stuff. And the good news for you is it more or less confirms what you think you're going to find. But specifically, though, I would caution against using density as your main measure of urbanity, because there are lots of nonlinear things going on. And so I look at commuting patterns, transportation patterns, age of the neighborhood, and so forth. I found those things often a much better predictor than density. And especially in the U.S., there are lots of areas that have dense sprawl, really dense places, which also are very car-oriented, which is sort of the worst nightmare from a civic point of view. So just don't use density as the single measure. And that's a big fault with economists, that they think density equals not sprawl, and it's more complicated than that.
In the interest of time, I'll just thank you.
Great. Many suburbs in the world, particularly those that are built right now, the ones that were built in Eastern Europe over the last 50 years, are much denser than many parts of many inner cities in North America. So density won't get you very far. And I think there's also a moral argument involved here, which is, I was going to comment longer, but in the interest of time, I won't. But on that long paragraph that you also read on what Jane Jacobs says about that I think is not cannot be argued, but we can take that offline. But the second point is goes back to the question of people like Glaser, and which is similar, and to your the core of your argument about mercantilism or the idea of the mercantile city, which is true, and we all know it's true. We go to Siena, and we know what you mean, and you go to Istanbul, you know what you mean. But there is another part of the city, which is the industrial city, which created different, totally different kinds of allegiances and different kinds of traditions that it gets completely drowned out by. For various reasons, by Florida and Glaser and Jacobs and all these people who basically treat the complex urban economy as if it was some small town with a marketplace, and in which small town values exist and protect small town interests. And I think that is really a huge danger if you look at places like Shanghai, or you know, any of the large now emerging cities in which completely different understandings of centrality, economy, and polity are now emerging.
And I think that's true, and it's a problem of specifying exactly what I mean, first of all, by mercantile city, and taking into account something that I was talking to Jacob Levy yesterday, and he brought it up. Detroit. I mean, it's an industrial city, but when you have an industry at that scale, you have to put it next to a place where you can ship. And even Adam Smith talks about this and makes it very explicit. So the distinction between exactly what makes it a mercantile city and what makes a non-mercantile city, I think the whole variable itself may be really problematic. But yes, I think I have to figure out exactly what I'm looking at. So I very much welcome the suggestion.
Okay, so the question was the historical transmission argument and the causal from the medieval times to today.
I think that a lot of work is done by the inheriting of the structure, but I think that the narrative of how we inherited the structure is, I don't know if there's any way to test this, but that the narrative of the way that we inherited the structure matters to some degree. So that... Yes. I mean, and it's the sense that there is the sense that we didn't just that this isn't just an artificial city that got created. Our allegiance to this city is more than just one big factory town. It may develop out of a factory town, but in fact, that for example, the streets, the way that New York functions, the way that Montreal functions, the way that streets wind, and that there's a certain dynamic there that can be done and violence can be done against it by simply reducing it to a structural argument. So I don't know how to operationalize it or whether I need to operationalize it for this, but I think that there's a narrative that gives meaning and context and creates allegiance. It's not. The structure may tend in one direction or another, but it's set in context. I mean, it's a Robert Cover argument that the nomos has to depend on a narrative in order to make some sense.
Great, thanks so much.